For those of you who are unfamiliar with the role of Council Generals, I'm the Welsh Government's law officer, so I'm responsible for providing legal advice to the First Minister and other Welsh ministers on a wide range of matters affecting devolved government in Wales. And that wide range of matters includes the very important issues being discussed here today. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the Wales Act 2017 in the environment of Brexit, Article 50 in the Miller judgment, and in that context, what the challenges are for the next 2 years and certainly beyond. So no doubt you're all aware of these issues, issues of such significance that they seem to dominate the front pages on an almost daily basis, from Brexit and its constitutional impact, the triggering of Article 50, the use of the royal prerogative, which is an issue that I still think hasn't quite gone away, and closer to home, the eventual establishment, and I think the inevitable eventual establishment of a Welsh legal jurisdiction, and of course the Wales Act, where we are with it, and what are some of the implications relating to it. Now, it's impossible to discuss the Act in isolation from all these other constitutional developments and pressures. So consideration of the Act and its merit requires an understanding of the wider constitutional landscape of the United Kingdom. In particular, the relationship of nations of the UK that they have or want to have with the central Westminster government, and even more topical and difficult questions of the relationship between the UK and its component nations and Europe. And I'll return to some of these issues in greater detail later on. Now, turning to the Wales Act, many of you will be aware of the widespread criticism that it received prior to and throughout its journey through Parliament. And while significant improvements have been made since we first saw the bill in July 2015, it is certainly my view that it is never going to be, and perhaps was never intended to be, the Wales Act to end all Wales Acts. So we are going to face, I think, the requirement of further legislation in this area in the future. Despite the ambitious pronouncements from the UK government at the start of the process, this Act isn't going to provide the lasting devolution settlement that Wales needs and deserves, and we had hoped we were going to have. Questions about the devolution of justice, the establishment of a single Welsh jurisdiction, amongst other things, will continue to haunt the settlement and its long-term viability for the foreseeable future. One consequence is that we will lose some of the flexibility provided by the existing conferred powers model of devolution, following the judgment of the Supreme Court in the agricultural wages case. This case centred on a piece of proposed Assembly legislation, the Agricultural Sector Wales Bill. This was a bill to counter the decision of the UK government to abolish the Agricultural Wages Board, which determined wages and some terms and conditions of employment in respect to some 13,000 agricultural workers in Wales. It was challenged by the UK government in the Supreme Court. They argued it was an employment matter, which was not devolved, and we argued it was an agricultural matter, which was devolved. That was the prime objective, and the court found in favour of the Welsh government. This is all sort of historic knowledge. I'm sure most of you are very familiar with the background to that and the implications of that particular judgment. The unanimous judgment, though, provided that an Assembly bill will be within competence as long as it can be shown to fairly and realistically relate to a conferred devolved subject. So whilst acknowledging that a bill will often touch upon other subjects, both devolved and non-devolved, it puts the connection to a conferred subject at the heart of the existing settlement. So as long as we can prove a relationship with a devolved subject and that a bill does not fall within a listed exception, it does not matter if the bill relates to other subjects not listed at all. Now, some may say this is an expansive interpretation. Others may say, as I do, that it is actually just a common sense approach. The judgment was, however, and it's very clear that this is the case, that it was the main political driver behind the Wales Act, and in particular the move to a reserved powers model of devolution. In fact, this was expressly acknowledged in the UK government's command paper, Powers for a Purpose, where the UK government commented that it is time to reset the devolution settlement for Wales. So, as I will argue later, the move to a reserve powers model marks a largely positive step forward for Wales. However, there is no getting around the fact that there are subjects such as employment and industrial relations, which currently fall within the Assembly's competence under the conferred powers model, but which will in future be expressly reserved to the UK Parliament. How that works out will remain to be seen, but it is under the existing conferred powers model that we are bringing the Trade Union Wales Bill to repeal parts of the UK Trade Union Act, which we consider undermines our social partnership approach to public service delivery. Now, despite this, there are reasons to remain positive. The Act marks another important stepping stone on Wales's devolution journey. In particular, the move to a reserved powers model will bring Wales into line with other devolved legislatures in Scotland and Northern Ireland. And as the First Minister for Wales has said, this is likely to prove particularly important during the imminent Brexit negotiations, where questions of existing devolved responsibilities across the United Kingdom and the current EU powers are likely to take centre stage. So Wales and the Welsh Government need to be at the heart of these negotiations, and having the ability to align ourselves with other devolved administrations where appropriate to do so will be a crucial negotiating tool. In other areas, the Wales Act also enhances legislative and executive devolution in line with the Silk Commission and the Smith Commission reports, and begins to bridge the gap between the Welsh settlement and other devolution settlements in the UK. Now, significantly, the Assembly will now have the power to amend its own electoral system. Progress has also been made in the fields of energy, transport, ports and water, all areas where the Welsh Assembly and the Welsh Government will be able to exert increasing influence in the future. On a more technical note, I'm pleased to report that the removal of two of the four necessity tests, which haunted the original version of the bill, have gone. Along with the enhanced powers to enable the Assembly to modify the private law, this will go some way towards our ambition for a mature, coherent and stable settlement. And perhaps the most significant changes are also proposed in relation to the criminal law. The bill provides a list of offences alongside certain general criminal law principles which the Assembly cannot modify, but beyond that, the Assembly may legislate with confidence in relation to the criminal law, creating new offences and using existing criminal offences to make its devolved legislation enforceable and effective. Criminal law is not the only area in which the bill will bring changes of substance, of course, but it neatly illustrates that our governing legislation will in future allow legislative divergence on a scale not hitherto experienced in Wales. We must rise to the challenge and be prepared for that. There was, of course, no easy passage for the Wales Act, and the arguments for and against it, I have to say, were very, very close. There were risks, though, of not supporting the bill within a Brexit environment where our constitutional structure is going to change, not just with the EU, but our national interrelationships. Inevitably, withdrawal from the EU will represent a fundamental constitutional change, not only for the UK, but for Wales as a whole. And in the context of that political environment, the Welsh Government and the National Assembly made a crucial judgment that it was in the interests of Wales to have the new devolution settlement in place before the UK commenced the formal process of withdrawal from the UK by triggering Article 50. Now, if the bill had not been supported, it is unlikely that there would have been any other legislation, that there would have been any further devolution of powers for the foreseeable future. The terms of exit from the EU and the domestic legislation that will need to be passed to give effect to the process of withdrawal is likely to dominate the UK and Welsh Government's legislative programme, I suspect, for many years to come. So the reserved powers model of devolution provided for in the Wales Act does represent a substantial change. I, I've argued with myself whether I should say a substantial step forward, but I don't think I can bring myself quite to say that. So as it certainly represents a substantial change to the process of devolution. And it will operate from the starting premise that the Assembly can legislate unless a provision relates to a subject that is specifically reserved to the UK Parliament. Instead of working for an assumption that the Assembly cannot legislate unless a provision relates to a conferred subject, in the long term, it should mean, following EU exit, that the Assembly will be able to legislate on any subject that is not reserved, in the absence of an EU regulatory framework. This will alter the Assembly's legislative competence, a point which was recognised by the Supreme Court in its recent judgment in the Miller case, where it said the removal of the EU constraints on withdrawal from the EU treaties will alter the competence of the devolved institutions unless new legislative constraints are introduced. And of course, that is an area we are looking at very, very closely. And the court further noted that in the absence of such new restraints, withdrawal from the EU will enhance the devolved competence. The Wales Act also protects other important aspects of Welsh devolution. Section 1 declares that the Assembly and the Welsh Government are permanent parts of the UK's constitutional arrangements, while Section 2 places the Sewell Convention, as it applies in Wales, on a statutory footing by making it clear that the UK Parliament will not normally legislate on devolved matters without the Assembly's consent. Now, it's put on a statutory footing, but it is still a political convention. It is not a justiciable convention, not at this stage, but this is certainly an area, again, that's going to have to be looked at very closely indeed in the post-Brexit constitutional structure of the United Kingdom, however that may develop, which is certainly something that there is a great deal of uncertainty about at the moment. The importance of the Sewell Convention was one of the reasons that led me to intervene in the Miller case. There were two main reasons for my intervention. First, a non-Sewell reason, that was basically to support the constitutional principle that people had voted to protect the sovereignty of Parliament, and that the sovereignty of Parliament was a fundamental part of our democratic structure and our process. 300 years ago, we had a civil war over this particular issue. So the idea that the government could ride roughshod over that was something I think that was, quite abhorrent or quite strange to us, that actually value the concepts of democracy and the rule of law. And I wanted to make clear that that allowing ministers to trigger Article 50 without Parliament's authorisation would have bypassed the important opportunity which the Sewell Convention provides for a dialogue between Parliament, the Assembly and the other devolved administrations. A dialogue that the Supreme Court recognises is essential to the proper functioning of the United Kingdom. And that was a very important part of our argument that we felt had to be represented in the Supreme Court, that what was being proposed, what was being suggested by the UK government in its arguments, was effectively use of the royal prerogative to bypass a convention which was established to enable the devolved arrangements to work, but it was a parliamentary convention. It was Parliament that has the choice whether or not to pass legislation or not, not the UK government and not by means of the use of the royal prerogative. We expect that convention to be respected and to be recognised by the UK government when it brings forward legislation for the domestic consequences associated with withdrawal from the UK. So one of the big issues that is going to affect us, leaving Sewell behind for the moment, is going to be the issue of the Repeal Act, what that entails, how the UK government actually sees the powers that currently reside in Brussels and where they should actually go. And Welsh Government has a very, very clear view on this, and that is those powers that relate to non-reserved matters that currently reside in Brussels must come back to the devolved administrations. And we must not see an environment where the Repeal Bill is used via the adoption of Henry VIII powers to basically place so much power and responsibility in the UK government, that it can override, it can bypass the parliamentary process, that it can bypass legislation that's been passed by Parliament, and that it can effectively, without any democratic right, overturn and override the constitutional structure we have and effectively redraw the Great Britain, the UK constitutional structure. So there are many political consequences from that that we need to be very alert to. And I think the other point to make is, of course, is that once we have left the EU, the UK constitution doesn't just go back to how it was before 1972. So the need for a new arrangement, a new relationship between the devolved administrations, a new constitutional structure whereby the decentralisation of power actually works in an environment where the powers, the responsibilities, the obligations and so on that existed by virtue of our membership of the EU don't totally disappear. So going back to how things were before, some of us do remember how it was before 1972, there's probably not many of us here, but there's a few of us who do. The world has changed considerably. It has become global, it has become international, hence the need for a whole variety of international conventions, obligations and responsibilities. Again, many of these which we will need to look at some stage. So those, I think, are some of the big challenges that are going to face us. And with the shortage of time, I'm quickly rushing through just to make sure that there isn't anything additional that I want. Only that we want stability. We need constitutional stability. We've heard a lot of talk in the start of this, as the first person to mention general election, talk about strong government and stability. But stability can mean many things and strong government can mean many things. What I'm very interested in is that we have a constitutional structure that actually works, that there is a decentralisation of power, that people's voices within our society is greater. And I think all of us as lawyers, whether it be within government, in private practice or whatever our field is, I think have a responsibility to make sure that that works and that we continue with a society that is based on fundamental principles of human rights and I think a recognition of the rights of individuals, of peoples, of nations and a structure that actually works. Thank you very much.